Happy New Year, everyone. You're listening to the Seat Control Podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. We've been gone for a short while. Work, school, the holidays, and in particular a reckless Camry driver all combined to put us back a few days. But hey, we're back. That's what counts. This is our last podcast for 2014, and I wanted to take a moment out to thank you for your listenership. This podcast has been such a pleasure, and I hope you've found it as interesting and fun to listen to as it has been for me to put together. If not, I appreciate the charity of your time. We'll call it a Christmas present. We've had such amazing support, adding to our production this year regular podcasts from Natalie Sambi of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute and the Phoenix think tank's Alex Clark, whose series of oral histories on the Falklands War continues. And don't worry, we'll have that and more coming for the next year, in particular the yet unaired interview with General Van Riper, United States Marine Corps retired. But today, I turn you over to our friend and fellow host, Natalie Sambi, for her podcast on airstrikes in Iraq. So sit back, relax, and enjoy, and in particular, have a wonderful holiday season.
And welcome back to another episode of SimSec's Sea Control, a podcast series brought to you by the Center of International Maritime Security. I'm Natalie Sambi, and I'm from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, and I'm the host of Sea Control's Asia Pacific series. Today I have two guests to discuss airstrikes in Iraq. The airstrikes campaign have been conducted against the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, and have involved not only the United States, but coalition partners like Australia. So this has been of keen interest to us and other defence watchers. We'll be back, however, after this short break.
Do you like the Sea Control podcast? Sure, we all do. However, we're only a small sea in the ocean of content available to you, our dear listener, at the SimSec website. Sign up for a membership at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. China may have a 9-dash line, but our seas are clear, and we welcome your opinions and articles. Please take a moment while downloading this podcast to leave us a 5-star rating and a comment. We need them. Seriously, how do you think we pay this electric bill? Money?
And thanks for joining us for another episode of Sea Control's Asia Pacific series. I have two guests today from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute to discuss the first 100 days of the airstrikes campaign against the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. Our institute has recently published a report on the first 100 days analysing where these airstrikes have occurred, how often they've occurred, and what impact they've had. Joining me today, I have two of our analysts. I've got Daniel Nicola and Patricia Diaz to discuss the research and methodology behind this report, the report's implications, Australia's role, and then we'll finish up a little bit about some broader security issues that are concerning Australia this year and in 2015. So without much further ado, I'd like to welcome my guests, Dan and Trish. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Natalie. Good to be with you.
Thank you very much.
Now, just to give a bit of background, in August this year, Barack Obama authorized two operations in Iraq, targeted airstrikes and a humanitarian effort. It's the airstrikes that we're concerned about today. And since then, it's been some 100 days, and our institute has collated the research into a report to discuss what these airstrikes are all about. So, Dan, I'd like you to kick off, first of all, just talk a little bit about what's been going on with those airstrikes,
to give
our listeners a snapshot of what's been going on.
So, Natalie, as you mentioned, on 7 August, Obama authorized two operations in Iraq, targeted airstrikes and a humanitarian mission. In the first month of airstrikes, they averaged about 20 in various cities across Iraq, until 10 September, when President Obama authorized his administration strategy to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIL.
Just to be clear, I mean, the targets here are obviously ISIL and ISIL infrastructure and individuals?
Correct. Okay. So in the first couple of months of the campaign, mobile targets are predominantly the focus. You see a lot of vehicles, some tanks, armoured personnel carriers and Humvees. And then as airstrikes increase and expand across into Syria, infrastructure becomes a lot more prominent in the targeting. And also mobile oil refineries and some of the financial aspects of the ISIL operation.
Right. And just to be clear, this is alongside other efforts like disruption of financial aids and
and other kinds of efforts?
Correct. So the coalition campaign is a broad four-pillar counterterrorism strategy. With the airstrikes are definitely what receives a lot of the sort of public commentary and a lot of analysis. But there definitely are coalition efforts to disrupt and degrade ISIL that extend beyond the coalition airstrikes. But as I was saying, with the 10 September announcement of the broader strategy to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIL, the effort expanded into Syria, and you see the Arab partners joined the US in conducting airstrikes there from 22 September. And our analysis shows that in almost every day since 22 September, targets have been hit in both Iraq and Syria. Coalition partners such as Australia joined the airstrike campaign in Iraq.
Yep.
Australia's first strikes commenced in 8 October.
And just to be clear, I mean, so we started in 8 of October. We started a little bit after that.
So our commitment began when Prime Minister Abbott announced on 6 October that we would join the effort, and 8 October was the first combat mission that we flew with our American partners, resulting in strikes destroying an ISIL facility. Currently, in terms of coalition nations participating, the US references Australia, Belgium, Canada, Denmark, France, the Netherlands, and the UK operating in Iraq, and Bahrain, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates operating in Syria. Qatar did take part in the first strikes in Syria on 22 September, but since then hasn't participated and has dropped off the US reporting efforts of coalition partners.
All right, so are you able to give me just some quick snapshot data on the number of airstrikes? Because I remember during the launch the other day, you actually delivered quite a startling figure.
Yeah, so on our count, based on US Central Command news releases, which was the primary source of data that we analysed, as of 24 November, which was the time of writing of our report, a total of 999 airstrikes have been conducted by the coalition across Iraq and Syria. And as of 15 December, which is the latest CENTCOM briefing that has emerged into the public domain, on our count, 1,242 airstrikes across both countries.
Excellent. And just in terms of what we've done with all those, you mentioned that a lot of that data has come from CENTCOM. We've now translated that into a report. What were the main findings of that report?
Yeah, sure. Most of the data that we did collate did come from CENTCOM. We tried to separate other country reportings just so that we didn't have an overlap in reporting and data. And as Dan keeps mentioning as well, you know, mentioning the fact that from our count, it is because we also defined a strike basically as a kinetic action, and we don't consider that to also be a sortie or the type of ordnance or the number of ordnance dropped as well. So in terms of what we could have drawn out, what struck us most about the data from my point of view were the types of targets being struck and trying to understand the strategy behind that. So initially what we see is a lot of vehicles being targeted at the start, and then obviously it's a strategy, I suppose, of a bit of containment in trying to stop the spread of ISIL in and throughout Iraq. And after that, you see them move into more infrastructure, so trying to starve them off their resources, and that's why Dan mentioned targeting the oil refineries and so on. So I guess what we can really see from the data is that they're highly targeted strikes compared to previous wars that they have done in Iraq. I think a lot of people draw a lot of comparisons to the past, but this time around, they've been very targeted, which is why you see such a reduced number of strikes compared to the past. And Kobani's significance, I think. A lot of people have spoken about Kobani. Kobani struck, I think, 282 strikes when we did our count as of 24th of November. I mean, Mosul Dam was the next highest, which was less than half of that at 139.
Is there any assessment about whether those strikes have been effective in Kobani or in Mosul?
So what you see in Kobani is a spike in airstrikes targeting ISIL fighting positions and units, as opposed to vehicles and some infrastructure across Syria. So I guess what that suggests to us is this has very much become sort of a symbolic, I guess almost propaganda war by ISIL, and they're literally throwing almost cannon fodder towards the town. And as the US CENTCOM commander has said, if ISIL keeps throwing up easy targets, we will keep hitting them. So in terms of strategic value, Kobani is not that important, and quite a number of analysts make that point.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the US and the coalition's point of view is that if ISIL presents itself, they will be struck, and Kobani just offers a lot of easily identifiable military targets for the coalition to strike.
And I'm just peering over at your page now. So out of the 999 as of mid-November, that's 282, so it's roughly a third
of the strikes have been directed just to Kobani itself.
Correct.
That's
yeah.
right. Okay.
And if you put that in comparison to the campaign against Mosul Dam, for example, which strategically was a lot more important than Kobani, with 139 strikes on our count as of 24 November, I think that shows the relative effort that's being thrown at Kobani and just how easily the coalition can identify military targets there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Dan mentioned earlier, Trish, that this has been collated from Central Command data.
That's right.
And obviously we've not only got the number of strikes, but their location, and then we've been able to develop an interactive map and all the maps I can see in the report now. How did you guys go about doing that, and can you talk a little bit about the database itself?
Yeah. So with ASPE, we built a database out of all of the media reports that came out from the 8th of August up until the 24th of November.
So all open source?
All open source. All open source information that came out of CENTCOM. There were some strikes that didn't come out of the CENTCOM website but came out of their CENTCOM YouTube site. So we compiled maybe under five from their YouTube site. And We ended up getting the location based. We did have a bit of difficulty in certain areas because sometimes the spelling can vary with a lot of the locations in Iraq. But again, we just got the mapping details and coordinates from online sources to put together our online interactive maps and also our maps in there. In terms of effect and outcomes, CENTCOM reported that for us. In certain instances, they wouldn't provide you how many. It'll just be a plural, you know, we struck this many. So in those instances in the report, we put, you know, greater than equal to figures and a minimum and maximum column. But when we tabulated all of the data, we considered, say, a greater than 2 effect or outcome, we would equal that to a 2. So it's more on the conservative side. Mm-hmm. Of data when you are looking at it. So, but that's how we managed those vague information sets and also ambiguities that came up.
And the database is available online, is that correct?
The database is available online.
At our website?
That is at our website, first100days.asfi.org.au.
Yep.
And that can be downloaded from there along with a copy of the report. That's there, and you can also find the links to all of our maps online as well as our interactive maps.
Excellent. Yep. Okay, great. And just on that side note, what does the map show?
Yep. So the map that we've got, our interactive maps, actually a fantastic tool to use as an analyst or even someone who's just curious and interested about what's going on. It's very easy to use. We've got 4 different tabs that you can play around with. So we've got a strike totals map that looks at all the different strikes that have been hit in Iraq and Syria, and you can take a close look at the total number in those locations. You've also got the individual strikes, which I find the most interesting because you go into that tab and you click on the individual dots or the markers on the map, and you click on that, it gives you all the information that we've collated from our spreadsheets. So
right.
Date, location, the sources, effect and outcomes, what was actually hit. It also, when available, provides you with YouTube clips for those particular strikes, so you get a great visual of what actually happened in that location. That's for all 999 strikes on there. We've also then got a tab for a timeline, so you can see the flow of strikes and how that's impacted. It's very interesting if you actually scroll the timeline across to the 22nd of September, you see that's when the Syria strikes come into play as well, and you
right.
see a lot of the coalition partners come into it. So the map just almost lights up with the number of strikes that moves on from there on in.
Wow.
And lastly, we have one more tab, is aid drops. So we look at the military and humanitarian aid drops, and similar to the individual strikes tab, that also has all the detailed information of what was dropped. And
how do the humanitarian drops compare with the airstrikes in terms of, I mean, do they roughly match up, or are they sort of in different areas? Is it much more dispersed?
So the humanitarian airdrops were mainly focused around Sinjar and the Mount Sinjar operation in August. So there were a number of humanitarian airdrops there. By Australian forces as well as US and UK aircraft, and I think French aircraft as well. The military airdrops, there's a US military airdrop that resupplies Kurdish forces in Kobani, which is quite interesting, that shifted military aid from Kurdish forces on behalf of them to resupply.
And Australia's part of that, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
Yeah.
Australia takes part in the aid drops. I think they've contributed quite a bit.
Cool. And just wanted to sort of go through some of the analysis in the report. One of our colleagues, Ben Shrier, obviously talks about the strategic arc of this campaign and sort of says it's too early to tell what contribution there is from a strategic perspective. That said, all of this data you've collated, I'm just wanting to know, what can we draw out from that? What are the key messages you think that this data can tell us?
I think from looking at the data as a whole from our collation, the overarching pattern of airstrikes during at least the first 100 days is relatively limited yet increasing in number. That's the overarching pattern. Since the spike when strikes commenced in Syria, coalition has launched an average of about 94 airstrikes per week, or about 13 per day, which relatively speaking is quite a limited application of force. And that's quite a deliberate component of the US-led campaign. It's an incentive-based, iterative approach that's contingent on Iraqi security forces doing the groundwork for themselves, owning the campaign. This is not a campaign of shock and awe. It's very much a limited use of air power to assist Iraqi ground forces retake territory controlled by ISIL.
I think Dan's given a great summary in terms of the coalition point of view and their sort of strategy behind that. And I briefly mentioned before in terms of targeting ISIL itself and looking at its movement and infrastructure. But I think what's interesting in the data as well and what you can draw from it in ISIL's behaviour is if you look at it at the start, you look at their movement, they're travelling convoys, they've got a lot of open movement. So you see a lot of targets that are being hit. And from that, you can sort of understand their behaviour and what they were doing in Iraq, what they've been doing in Syria. And so you see more recently a lot of targeting of bunkers, construction vehicles, which suggests, you know, in the later months they've obviously learned, they've adapted, they're not as open and moving around in large convoys. They're going underground, hiding their assets underground. You see a lot of targeting of training camps, so peak up in the middle there of the campaign of those first 100 days. So it seems as though they came in, were relatively free to settle, set up shop and camp, and then you see the strikes start targeting them, and again it starts dying off on the end there. Right. So I think in that way the campaign is effective in what it is trying to achieve.
Yep.
Also, likewise with units as well. You see them sort of come out in a lot of smaller units. They move to larger units, and obviously they would have seen that as, you know, too risky, having those targeted quite a bit. They shifted again down to smaller units and then moved out into tactical units, which are now being more were targeted more at the end of the 100-day assessment.
I think the other point I would make is that if you look at some of the targeting data that we've collated, about 1,000 targets of the 1,300 struck have been mobile targets, ISIL vehicles, units and fighting positions. And I think what this also shows is the very narrow rules of engagement that the US has imposed on the coalition campaign for the reasons I outlined earlier, to avoid collateral damage and to keep the campaign very much focused on smacking down ISIL when it raises its head. But this is not going to be a sort of a shelling of Mosul or some of the strongholds where ISIL is embedded within civilian populations. Mm-hmm. That sort of rollback of ISIL-controlled territory has to be done by ground forces.
Yeah. So I think at the current sort of airstrike campaign point of view, it is just literally to stunt the growth. It won't be necessarily to eradicate it unless you get the boots on the ground.
Sure. Okay. Thanks for that assessment. I mean, it's obviously important for the rest of the world to understand what Australia's contribution has been to this particular campaign as well. But I wanted to move on a little bit, and both of you have been working at ASPI for some time now, and I just wanted to get both of your assessments on the other sorts of security issues and defence issues that Australia has been facing, not only this year, but will be coming up in 2015. Dan, I know that you're going to be working on some surface fleet issues as well as fisheries issues. Trish, I know you're going to be working in Northeast Asian security. What I wanted to give our listeners, basically, is an impression of the kinds of priorities Australia is also pursuing other than the campaign in Iraq. We actually have a lot of issues concerning Indonesia, the changing military balance around China and the South China Sea, for instance, the Indo-Pacific, the South Pacific for us, and you know, the level of stability exercised or enjoyed in those islands, are of all constant concern to us. Let's just talk first, Dan. I want to ask you a little bit about pressing issues in defence capability. Mm-hmm. what's coming up on the horizon for Australia in 2015? So this year we had submarine. That was a big decision there. We've still got the questions as to whether or not we're going to go with the Japanese model. There's news yesterday that the Germans think this and Kruppsel think that they're in the running. What else is on the priority list for defence capability, particularly where maritime is concerned?
Well, I think 2015 is going to be a big year for Australian force structure and force structure priorities. We've got the defence white paper due to be released in the middle of the year, which will also be coupled with the first principles review of defence. There's also the industry policy statement that will come out sometime next year. So there's a lot happening within the defence policy landscape in Australia. As you mentioned, Nat, we had the conference, ASPE's international conference this year, focusing on the future submarine choice, which is still very much a live issue and a live debate.
Absolutely.
In Australia. A lot of money riding on the final decision and some huge choices for government coming up in the next couple of months. But the debate extends further than the submarine. The surface fleet also faces a number of challenges over the next couple of months, and we'll be hosting next year in March and April ASPE's International Conference on the Future Surface Fleet.
Mm-hmm.
We have the air warfare destroyers and the landing helicopter docks about to enter service, and also some big decisions to make about the future frigates. Also some big choices about the future of the naval shipbuilding industry within this country, and that's a big part of the force structure debate, is the industry elements and the sort of economics that underpin all of that.
Just to give our listeners a bit of background, the shipbuilding industry has often been based out of South Australia. It's something that defence ministers in the past have promised to actually invest in and maintain. Again, our colleagues, Dr. Thompson and Dr. Davies, have often brought up questions about the efficacy and the longevity of this particular industry when you've got lulls in activity, the so-called valley of death, and how we're going to be overcoming that and whether or not it's worth to keep investing in this industry. So just to give you a bit of background.
Yeah, exactly right. And you have the Australian Shipbuilding, Australian Submarine Corporation, I should say, ASC, its future again being slightly undecided. There's press reports emerging that it might be privatised, a lot of questions about its future. So all these sort of these government choices are going to be decided in 2015, and it's going to be a big year.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And just in terms of other priorities, Dan, I know that you're also working on regional fisheries engagement. Some of our listeners may be wondering why our fishery is so important to us. Well, obviously, you know, we're an island surrounded by a lot of countries that have maritime concerns. Legal fishing is a big, big issue for a lot of them, and fishing sustains the livelihood of a lot of countries, underpins the economy of a lot of countries in our region.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that's a big part of Australia's regional fisheries engagement, is its broader effect to the Southwest Pacific Island nations in particular. So Australia has a history of being quite active in this space. And I think it's sort of a good time to do a strategic overview of how we engage with these regional fisheries management organisations, where we engage, what our priorities are, what we're trying to achieve, and how we can best go about doing that. So at the moment we're conducting a research study on those issues, and hopefully we'll reach some answers by next year.
All right. So moving from domestic defence priorities as well as to the Southwest Pacific, I'm going to move north a little bit now. Trish, looking at the priorities for Australia in Northeast Asia, because given that we've talked a lot about Indonesia and Southeast Asia in the past, I mean, ASPE is obviously engaged in this area quite a bit, but because for us, strategic rivalry between China and the United States is a big issue. Questions about Japan's remilitarization, I think I talked about with Dr. Shreya and our colleague Tomo in the past. What else? What else is on the agenda for Australia to watch in 2015 for Northeast Asia?
So I think Northeast Asia, one of the things that's been there for quite some time and that we can't easily forget is obviously the Korean Peninsula security issue that's on there. That's always a constant and a sort of lively engagement. I think one thing for sure is from Australia's point of view in terms of interest, unification is something that we're not, that I would say isn't on the cards, because I think with that you comes a lot of responsibility as well. It comes, you know, you get a lot of humanitarian issues that would also follow that you need to be able to support. And I don't think currently we are ready for that sort of contribution, especially given that our aid budgets have also been reduced.
So it's not a priority for Australian government policy, in other words?
Yeah, I think I think that the priority in policy is just stability, I'd say, on that in that front. The other issues that are on the cards are definitely the non-traditional security challenges. You know, the human trafficking side of things, border protection is obviously a very big part of that. We're a very big island, and securing our borders and maritime outer maritime area is also very important. The other thing too is looking at peaceful resolutions to territorial disputes and preventing conflict in areas like South China Sea, Senkaku, Diaoyu Island disputes. We have a lot of economic activity and shipping routes that transit through there. And again, the point of view I think on that, or the government's position I would say on that, is just maintaining stability and seeking peaceful resolution into those issues.
Yeah, China's obviously a major trading partner for Australia as well. We don't want that to be used as leverage.
Well, that's right. That's right. And that's something I think is a bit of a debate in ASEAN as well, having that in there. Cybersecurity, I think, has come to the forefront as well in Northeast Asia, and Australian interest in that as well, working and engaging with them. Australia's pushing for a new cybersecurity centre as well. I think it's recently opened. We've got one of our senior analysts heading the review for Australia that's recently been announced as well. And I think there's also a focus on peacekeeping. I think there's an area that Australia could do a lot more in. It's definitely on the cards for discussion. I think Australia's looking at having a dialogue coming up, not at a government level, but, in a 1.5 perspective, and engaging with all of these countries in the region to see how we can move forward in addressing some of these issues and what can be resolved from there. So,
all right. Thanks for that, Trish. Just to give you a little bit of a summary, those are the issues Australia will be looking at first in 2015, amongst other things. Of course, we'll still have our gaze on Southeast Asia, probably more so than some of our colleagues over in the United States, simply because of our geography. More than anything, we also have pressing issues to do with force structure and capability arising in 2015, where we'll have a new defence white paper, which is a statement of our national defence and national security strategy in one. And just to sum up, we have our resources that we talked about a little bit earlier on the 100 days of the campaign against ISIL. Just to recap, if you're interested in the database or the interactive map, you can find some of those resources at first100days.aspi.org.au. Just to confirm, that's FIRST 100 in numbers, DAYS.ASPI.org.au. And I'd like to thank my guests today, Trish and Dan, for sharing their time to talk a little bit about that campaign, our report, and their thoughts on Australian defence issues. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Natalie. Thanks for having us.
And, of course, you can download and listen to any one of the SimSec podcasts and Sea Control, available not only through iTunes, but also on the website simsec.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a wonderful holiday Christmas period.